I'm going to be talking about a few things. This is a quick outline. I will address the new developments in GINA, namely the steps 3 and step 4. Earlier today, Dr. Dabar addressed GINA in its entirety, essentially, and went over details, so this should make my task a bit easier to achieve. I will highlight features of formoterol and fluticasone. I will then address comparative studies of the flutiform, which is the device containing fluticasone and formoterol versus its monocomponents. And then I will go briefly over the comparative studies of flutiform versus other comparable ICS-LABA combinations that we've been using in the care of our patients over the past years. I will close by talking about the device attributes, mostly PMDI versus DPI, which I think is important to mention, especially that we do face lots of problems with drug delivery. Now, as you've seen this before, I will go over a few important details in it. This is GINA 2015, and essentially we noticed that there is this new continuum, this new circle that I think is addresses better how we understand asthma today. Then you have the steps down there and the options for controller and for maintenance, essentially. So what is this circle about? Well, it pinpoints the importance of continuity in addressing asthma in our patient care. It is very important, at least for me as a practitioner, to keep reminding myself and my patient that this is a condition that is chronic, that is always there, that the patient has, whether he feels it or not. So it's a continuous effort. I have to make sure that I make the proper diagnosis, that the symptoms are controlled, risk factors and triggers are actually controlled. I need to make sure that whatever I prescribe as an inhaler to my patient, that patient will know how to use. And it is tremendous and almost mind-boggling to me how this has been a very challenging and such a challenging point in getting across to my patient. It is amazing what this does to my patient compliance and the control of my condition. Asthma medications now are quite available. Their therapeutic window is very favorable, so we can do better with less, and we can address their needs. We also have the non-pharmacologic strategies, which do have a place and are important in controlling our asthmatic conditions, and the modifiable risk factors. Without controlling those, our asthma control becomes more difficult to achieve. Then I have to review the response after I've adjusted treatment and make sure that I prevent exacerbations, watch for any side effects, make sure my patient is satisfied, and make sure that my lung function is optimized. And the circle goes again and again and again. So it's a continuum that I need to always be aware of. It's not a one-shot deal. And whenever I let go, my patient will suffer and I will fail in maintaining my patient. Now, GINA has suggested the stepwise approach. You're quite familiar with that. I will not touch on the steps 1, 2, and 5. I will go over steps 3 and 4 because in those steps, there has been a bit of a change in the strategy that GINA adopted. And essentially, it talks about formoterol-containing compounds. Two molecules, the budesonide formoterol and the beclomethasone, dipropionate formoterol, they also have the MART approach, if you will, or the maintenance and reliever therapy, which the other compounds like the mometasone, formoterol, and our product here, the fluticasone formoterol, do not carry. But nonetheless, this molecule, the formoterol, which I will touch upon in detail later on, is, to me, the best LABA because it allows me two things that are very important. One of them is flexibility. So I will touch upon those in due time. But in step 3, essentially, we have our controller option. You have your low-dose ICS-LABA, and this is the preferred option, of course, and you have other options that you can use instead, or if you don't, if your patient particularities do not allow you to do that with the low-dose ICS-LABA. Leukotriene receptor antagonists do have a place. Theophylline still has a place. And in the most recent, I think, GINA, or maybe 2014 and 15, tiotropium was added as an additional option in achieving control in our uncontrolled asthmatics. So what GINA did was that it added the ICS-LABA as part of the reliever, if you will, and especially with those two compounds that I mentioned. Step four is pretty much the same thing as step three, except that you're talking about a higher dose of ICS. And it is clear from studies, and they were also mentioned in the previous presentation, that the addition of a long-acting beta agonist is better than doubling the dose of steroids. So having said that, what are the current guidelines about? Well, GINA guidelines advocate an ICS-LABA, because like I said, ICS-LABA are superior to doubling the dose of ICS or ICS alone. Of course, ICS is the backbone of asthma. Now we're having a paradigm shift in our management of COPD, whereabouts we don't regard ICS as the backbone anymore. It's the bronchodilators. Not so in asthma. In asthma, corticosteroids remain the backbone of our asthma management. Now, the guidelines do not tell us exactly which ICS-LABA combination may be the most appropriate for a particular patient, but they do mention a few particularities of a certain combinations, especially when it comes to the formoterol. Of course, you know, randomized control trials are the standard that we use whenever we're talking about a certain compound, whenever we're comparing one compound to another, whenever we're conducting superiority studies or non-inferiority studies. So they are important for that purpose. The problem with them is that randomized control trials are limited. They are quite selective by nature. So they may not represent what we see in our everyday care of our patients. And also from a previous presentation that you saw, there was a mention of the David Price study, for example, that was a real-life study. An everyday study, when we look at patients and we say, okay, that's what I have. This patient would not have crossed the inclusion-exclusion criteria for my randomized controlled trial, but I still need to treat that patient. I can't tell him, sorry, we don't have enough to treat you per se because you continue to smoke. Come back when we have a study on smoking. We have to treat them anyway. That's what we do every day. We go outside the boundaries of the recommendations from the designs of the studies, and we apply them to everyday care. And we're going to continue to do that. But now, at least, we appreciate the importance of real-life studies. So when selecting the most appropriate therapy, physicians should take a patient-centered approach. We need to always keep our focus on our patient. This is what matters. Why is this important? Because, like I said, I need to make sure that my patient's condition, which is a chronic inflammatory condition, is controlled. And I need to make sure that the adherence is preserved as best as possible. And the problem with adherence has to do with lots of things. One of them is my patient preference, and hence it is incumbent upon me to provide my patient with the best available tool to provide them with what they want, which is getting controlled quick and having a good medication that maintains their control. So maintenance and controller, these are two issues that have made it difficult for us to keep patients on medications. You also saw in the previous study a quick word about the compliance with leukotriene. This is the PRICE study again. So the compliance with leukotriene receptor antagonist was higher. It was quite superior to the inhalers. Why? Because it's a pill and it's once a day. And also it does not have the steroid phobia that we deal with on a daily basis with our patients. So if we can address those issues and we have a good communication with our patients, I would touch upon that also during my presentation, then we can achieve what we desire, which is controlling our condition and keep it controlled at the lowest cost for our patient. So patients want rapid onset of action. I always argued that patients with asthma are compliant. They are compliant. I think they are compliant with what they believe works. They love their rescue inhaler. They use it all the time. They keep it in their pockets. They keep it in their car, in their offices, at work. Everywhere they go, it's with them because it does what they want it to do. It gives them relief immediately. That's what they want. So they are not aware what the price is. They're not aware how bad this might be. But this is what they really want. So unless I can address those needs while maintaining my focus on what they required to have that condition controlled, then I will not actually have a hard time convincing my patients to remain on the medications. And this is actually a study that was done that looked at what are the attributes that patients want essentially. Well, they want a medication that is potent, that works. They want it to work when they want it to work. So it has to be immediate, essentially, or very quick. They want to make sure that the problem that they are addressing is actually taken care of. So this is exactly what I want them to get from my medication. And this was seen regardless of the severity or across all the severities of asthma, from mild to moderate to my severe asthmatic. As you know, severe asthma is not equivalent to uncontrolled or difficult to control asthma. As a matter of fact, the more difficult patients are not those with very severe asthma. Those usually, because they are symptomatic, and when they are symptomatic, they are more symptomatic and they are sicker than others, they tend to be a bit more compliant probably. They tend to listen a bit more. They tend to follow up a bit better. Usually it's the milder patient. Young, mild to moderate, these are the ones that may not perceive the severity of their condition. Their insight to how bad their condition is flawed. So these patients cannot be really trusted in telling us why or how they are doing with their asthma. This is the fifth question, if you will, in the ACT, which tells you how do you perceive your asthma? How do you see you perceive your asthma control? This is a problem because patients do not perceive their asthma control properly all the times. And if I can pinpoint those patients, it is incumbent upon me to make sure I watch those. These may be the more difficult to control patients as compared to the others. I talked about this when I said that I believe that patients are compliant with the rescue medication. This is the study, the Asthma Insights and Realities in Europe. And Klaus Rabe, when he completed the study, it was actually quite shocking because this is what ends up happening. Across all severities of asthma, the use of rescue albuterol was tremendous. So you're talking about mild intermittent, this was the old classification, mild intermittent, mild persistent, moderate, and severe persistent, 44%. To 81% in the moderate persistent and 76% in the severe persistent. Across the whole stratum of asthma patients, 63% of patients were actually using their rescue medication. And even worse, if you look at the frequency of that use of rescue medication, 3/4 of patients were using the rescue medication every day. Every day. Actually, if you look at the number of actuations, essentially, or inhalations per day, some of them, about 5%, were needing more than 9 puffs per day, additional 9 actuations of their rescue inhaler every day. So we do have a problem. Our patients, mine at least, I guess yours as well, they do this. They require and they rely on the rescue medication, and that's why they keep it close to them. So if I can answer their need of immediate relief, which is what they want, and I get what I want, which is good control via a potent anti-inflammatory, a good potent steroid, then I would have probably done a huge step in achieving and maintaining control of my patients. So the attributes important to patients, well, immediate effect essentially. They want their bronchodilator to work immediately. Patients prefer them when they are quick and without noticeable side effects, and they want them to not cause them undue problems, essentially, in terms of side effects. So if I can actually do that, the adherence will be improved. The perception of patients for the cost-benefit of their medication is very important. It turns out that the high benefit and low risk is where you want to be. If I can get my patients to believe that this medication will provide them with the highest level of activity at the lowest possible cost to them in terms of side effects, and here I'm alluding to steroids in particular, I would have achieved my objective. Hopefully I'll be able to sort out a few details that I can use in my everyday care of my patients. Now, you know about ICS-LABA, their pharmacological profiles. I'm going to go over each one of them, the fluticasone first. But before then, I will talk just a couple words about the deposition, lung deposition. As you know, we always have a problem with getting the medication to the target area. So if you look at the literature, you will find that over the past years, we've made some progress. In the past, it used to be 90% is oropharyngeal deposition, 10% reaches the target tissue, which is the local therapy in the airways. Now we're getting much better with the small particles, with the customized formulations that allow better deposition to the target area and the more distal, mostly the small airways. Of course, the lesser the amount of the systemic circulation and the first pass, and the then the better it is. And this is going to, I will show that eventually when I discuss the attributes of my corticosteroid use. What are the pharmacological considerations in picking any steroid? Well, receptor binding. The higher the receptor binding, the better the pharmacological efficacy. Commonsensical, okay. How about the plasma protein binding? The higher the plasma protein binding, the less the amount available for side effects, for systemic side effects. So if I have a medication that has a very high protein binding, this is also an attribute that I would find desirable and helpful for my patient care. The inhalation half-life. Okay, I managed to get the drug to the target tissue. How long does it stay there? Does it stay there for the duration? If it does, then I know that my patient will maintain his control with that medication without the need for rescue because it's still there working at the target site. Volume of distribution, this is a tricky one because it has to do with the patient body habitus, with the amount of fat, and it has to do with the pharmacokinetics of the medication and its lipophilicity. So the volume of distribution is important. The higher the volume of distribution, the more likely you are to bump into certain side effects with the medication. The oral bioavailability, of course, commonsensical. The lower it is, the better it is. And I always tell my patients, like I'm sure you do, to make sure we take additional steps to minimize it by mouth rinsing and so on and so forth. And finally, the systemic clearance rate. You want the medication to be cleared at a rate that would be desirable, not to cause stacking and buildup of medication in the system. So does fluticasone as a molecule answer some of those attributes? As a matter of fact, it's not bad at all. It does do that. It has a very good in vitro receptor binding compared to the molecules that are mostly used in the everyday practice that we're doing. Plasma protein binding is also very high, reflecting a low amount available for side effects. Inhalation half-life is also desirable, covering the range that I want in my patient care. And distribution volume is high. Now, this, the distribution volume being high, is an issue regarding the, because it's a lipophilic medication, and it may actually, it's higher than the others, like, for example, budesonide, which is more hydrophilic. The systemic clearance rate is slow because of that. It's lipophilicity, and that's why we need to be careful with its use. How about the LABA? Well, LABAs are wonderful medications. Cannot use them on their own. It's not recommended in asthma like it is in COPD. What do I want from my LABA? What my patient wants, which is effectiveness and immediate benefit. So I want the speed of onset to be very quick, and that's what formoterol does. This is what separates formoterol from lots of other beta agonists. The onset of action is comparable, if not identical, to albuterol. And it is a full agonist, and the duration of action spans the dosing protocol that I, dosing interval that I have. So what are the factors affecting successful drug inhalation and drug deposition? Well, appropriate treatment delivery requires a good inhalation technique. I do urge you to get placebo devices of all the medications that you're using, because I found that especially in patients that tell me that they know how to use it, these are probably the worst patients, because on top of not knowing, they're not aware that they don't know. It's actually worse because they have the misconception of knowledge, and it's actually quite dangerous. So I try to make sure that they demonstrate, if they can, the inhalation technique, how they use the device, and how they use the technique to ensure proper delivery of the medication. I can tell you that probably 70 or 80% of the time, I have something to correct, if not everything to correct, with their inhalation technique and how they handle the device. So I think these are very, very important. Particle sizes, we can talk about, we will talk about them, but we can talk till the cows come home. I think this is still a debatable issue. Get them to use the medication properly, to know the device. If it's a simple device, if it's something they're used to, that's why an MDI may be desirable, because that's what they're accustomed to. They love their MDIs. And that's when you can achieve better treatment delivery. Now, like I said, the particle size now is plat du jour, if you will. Everybody loves it. It's important. It's good. Because our technology is now allowing us to tailor the particle size to a degree that allows us to keep it in a certain range, which is a desirable range. So if you're talking about a particle size that's between, say, 1 micra to 5 micra, this is wonderful, because 1 micron will get to the distal airways, and 5 micra is still not going to deposit in the oral area, oropharyngeal area. So they will get to target areas depending on the size, and this is the formulation that I would prefer. I want something that would fit in that category, because I want to address my whole bronchial tree. This is where the money is. What goes into the alveolar space and sticks there or comes back, I'm not really sure what it does to us, except maybe increase the systemic bioavailability. But the target area, which is the major airways, smaller airways, and small airways, they should be targeted as best we can. And this is what is achieved with this formulation. Now, is it an efficacious molecule? Yes, fluticasone. One of the things that is well known about fluticasone is that it's a very potent steroid. It's one of the most potent molecules that we have. And this is shown in lots of studies. There's only a few of them. But in terms of fluticasone as compared to a molecule that's hydrophilic, budesonide, which is a great molecule as well, but in terms of its potency, fluticasone is a more potent molecule. How about the improvement in the, in other words, clinical translation, improvement in asthma control measures compared with budesonide? Also, some of the studies do not reach significance, but a few of them do reach significance and do set it apart as a more efficacious molecule in achieving the individual asthma control. It's a safe molecule. And again, we're talking about a certain range of dosages. So beyond a certain level, you will have systemic side effects in all the inhaled corticosteroids. And for fluticasone, for example, it's 1,000 micrograms. And if you are below this threshold, this medication is going to provide you with the effect that you need, the potency that you need at the target site without the undue side effects that are concerns to us and, more importantly, to my patients. My patients, like yours, I guess, they have this steroid phobia, which I need to alleviate every single time I talk to them. Some of them actually cut down on the medication on their own because they want to reduce the amount of steroids that they're using. And this is important to pinpoint to them, because when they do that and they end up with an exacerbation, they will require oral steroids, and everything that they've been trying to save, quote unquote, is going to be washed down the drain with the oral regimen. How about formoterol? Well, it's a molecule that has a very well-established efficacy profile. It is established in its effectiveness in preventing the need for rescue medication, and it is a very effective medication in achieving the asthma control. Now, it may be a bit unfair to compare formoterol, I guess, with salmeterol, because salmeterol is a great LABA, but it's known that its onset of action is quite delayed. You're talking about 15 to 30 minutes for onset of action, way too long for an asthmatic. This is a big issue, and that's why I think formoterol provides us with this very important attribute that my patients want and seek. It's a very safe molecule. Studies that have compared formoterol-containing compounds versus non-LABA-containing compounds, it showed that the likelihood of an event was reduced, or the probability of no event was increased with the formoterol-containing compounds, again, reflecting its safe profile. This is what actually made the study that was done in the UK. This is what made these recommendations come out from the survey that was given to UK practitioners regarding what they would consider as important attributes in picking their treatment for an asthmatic. And they picked essentially what we were talking about. They want something that is good or potent and that is fast and rapid. Makes sense. That's what patients want. That's what we want. If we can achieve that, we would achieve control. They would be happy with no symptoms. So I'm going to spend the remainder of the presentation in talking about the comparative studies between the fluticasone as a combination versus its monocomponents, so fluticasone and formoterol. And then I will compare it to the combinations with formoterol that we use on a daily basis and see whether we have something that is worthwhile considering. So this is essentially the study versus the monocomponent. It had four arms. The Flutiform 500. There was also the Flutiform 100, which is a dose-finding arm, essentially. And, of course, the Fluticasone 500 BID and the Fluticasone 500 and the Formoterol 24, which were given in two separate devices. And lo and behold, the high-dose Flutiform was similar to its component for the change in pre-dose FEV1. Which is not surprising, and the effect was seen across the study period of 8 weeks. And in terms of the change in post-dose FEV1, also it was similar to its component for the change in the post-dose FEV1 for the duration of the study. How about comparing fluticasone formoterol flutiform to the fluticasone propionate salmeterol? Well, this was an open label, actually, randomized, active control parallel group that compared the Flutiform 100/10 or 250/10 BID with fluticasone salmeterol 100/50 or 250/50 micrograms BID, which is the range that we use in our asthmatics. These were given in adult asthma patients with predicted FEV1 between 40% and 85%. The primary objective was to demonstrate non-inferiority. So this was a non-inferior study, which is what you do when you want to introduce a new compound and you compare it to the gold standard or the available medications for your patient care. So it was a non-inferiority study in terms of mean pre-dose FEV1 at week 12. There were some key secondary objectives, evaluation of the time to onset of bronchodilator action, and the assessment of discontinuations due to the lack of efficacy and clinically relevant measures of asthma control. So essentially, this is what you have. There were a pre-study therapy that was continued for 4 to 10 days, randomization. It was the Flutiform 100 or the 250/10, or the Andy fluticasone salmeterol 100 or 250/50. And they were followed for 12 weeks. And again, there was no inferiority. Non-inferiority was easily achieved with Flutiform found to be similar to fluticasone salmeterol for mean pre-dose FEV1 after 12 weeks. Of course, no surprise there. The onset of action was seen immediately with the formoterol containing Flutiform and was not seen with the salmeterol, where there is a delay of the long-acting beta agonist, which is one of the attributes of formoterol as a molecule. And the separation is seen very quickly, early on, and maintained for the duration. So it's important to keep that in mind because that's what our patients want. Now, it also provided a faster onset in the proportion of patients that are on the medication. So a bigger proportion of patients achieved this sooner, quicker, earlier, and it was maintained throughout the study period. How about comparing Flutiform with budesonide formoterol combination? So the aim of the study was to compare Flutiform 250/10 BID with budesonide formoterol 400/12 micrograms BID in adolescent and adult patients with asthma. The predicted FEV1 was between 50 and 80%, kind of similar to the previous study where it was about 40 to 85%. The primary objective, again, demonstrate equivalence and non-inferiority of Flutiform compared to budesonide formoterol based on the mean change in morning pre-dose FEV1 from the baseline to the end of the 12-week treatment period. So there was a run-in period with fluticasone 100 micrograms BID. for 2 to 4 weeks, and then there was randomization, one-to-one essentially, and you had the flutiform 250/10 BID and the budesonide formoterol dry powder inhaler 400/12 BID. One thing I forgot to mention, that the study that was done with the fluticasone salmeterol was done with the dry, with the MDI. It was a pressurized MDI versus pressurized MDI. We don't have this formulation in Lebanon. We have the discus, but in Europe and in the US, they have the pressured MDI for the fluticasone salmeterol. So again, going back to this, you have the comparison between the MDI versus the dry powder inhaler, and this was followed over 12 weeks. Again, equivalence was seen in the study with similar and comparable outcomes and change in mean morning predose FEV1 from baseline to week 12. Also, it was similar for the absolute mean FEV1 change throughout the study. So comparing the combination in flutiform to the budesonide formoterol showed the equivalence and non-inferiority in the 12-week study. I will finally touch over the some attributes that I found interesting and important in the delivery devices, essentially. I'm sure you've had the same problem that I had in figuring out what the literature has to say and whether that would make sense or not in terms of particle size, in terms of delivery devices, in terms of the resistance of the inhalers, in terms of all those different attributes that we are dealing with today. And we are, I think, fortunate to be living in times where we might be worried about what to pick and about too many choices as compared with the past, where we had only one or two different options. So the things I wanted to compare or focus on were the differences, or some key point differences, between the pressurized metered dose inhalers and the dry powder inhalers. Now, with the pressurized metered dose inhaler, of course, they do not require a forceful inhalation. They actually require a slow and deep inhalation with an inspiratory flow rate of less than 60 liters per minute, which is how we breathe, essentially. So it does not require a forceful inhalation. This is not the case with the DPI, by also logically, because the DPI is a powder, and it's a powder that is going to be pulverized. It's going to change into its powder form via the effort that the patient will deploy in getting the medication through. So slow, it requires a slow inhalation for the pressured metered dose inhaler, and you need a fast and deep inhalation for the dry powder to be able to suck in the drug in the inhaler device. Of course, with the pressured metered dose, slow inhalation is required to ensure that the drug deposits at the target area in the peripheral airways, as fast inhalation may increase the oral deposition. It's already coming at a pressure, so if my patient does an additional negative force of getting it in, you may end up with more oral deposition, and some of the particles that would be otherwise deposited more distally would be lost in the major oropharyngeal areas. In the DPI, fast inhalation rate is required to generate a large internal turbulent force in the device, required to break up this powder into its components so it can actually be in the particle size needed, which is the 1 to 5 micrometers or 2 to 5 micrometers that would allow it to deposit in the bronchial tree all the way to the small airways. Now, I looked this up, actually, and it's things that I had to learn because, well, it's hard to keep up with those. But different devices would require a different flow rate to get the clinically effective inspiratory flow. So depending on whether you're dealing with a pressured MDI, like what we're talking about here, it's 25 liters to 60 liters per minute, as compared to other devices. The clickhaler, for example, is even requires less force, 15 to 60 liters per minute, whereas the turbohaler and the AccuHaler, they require higher inspiratory forces, reaching 90 liters per minute at times. So the resistance of the inhaler device is important because, granted, in most patients it may not be an issue. Most patients, hopefully, will not be tight to the point where they cannot generate enough force to to fulfill the requirements of the device and the medication in it. But sometimes it may be crucial. In a kid, it's crucial. In an elderly, it's crucial. In somebody who has a disease that would make them more, makes it more problematic for them to get the medication across, resistance may play a role. So the metered dose inhalers, they are a low resistance device, relatively easy to generate a high inspiratory flow rate, and there is no necessity for the application of greater efforts to generate the inspiratory flow required, as mentioned previously. The dry powder inhaler, they have this issue with the need for the force to pulverize it and get it to target area. So in choosing the inhaler, the ability to generate the appropriate inspiratory flow is particularly important and is one of the things I think we should consider when we're looking at our patient and seeing which would be the best combination of medication and device that would allow me to achieve the objectives I want in that particular patient. And I would urge you to try to do this exercise. Of course, like I said, lung deposition depends on multiple factors. We've mentioned most of them, but the flow rate, the particle size, the plume characteristics, lots of data on this. You know what the plume is? Dr. Saliba, I think when she was talking about Zoo, she was showing this, the plume of Zoo, for example. This is how the powder or the mist is going to be dispersed. And that makes a difference in how it reaches and how long and how far it does actually go into the respiratory tree. So these are all important attributes that we need to keep in mind whenever we're dealing with the lung deposition. Like I said, the inhalation maneuver and the technique are very important. It's actually mentioned in GINA that you need to remind your patient on how to properly use the same inhaler that they've been on for a long time. We need to remind them on how to use it every 1 to 3 months. So it's very important. Every time they come for a follow-up, to remind them, so how are you using your inhaler? Can you show me? Okay, just wanted to make sure. Because that's important. People forget how to use it properly. So, in vitro, flutiform emitted a consistent fine particle fraction for the inhaled corticosteroid and LABA, and these were seen in studies compared to what we were discussing in terms of budesonide and the beclometasone dipropionate. And the inhaler flow here was 28.3 liters per minute, consistent with what we were talking about with the pressure dose MDI. And in vitro, the fine particle fraction of flutiform was compared with other ICS LABA, and a higher fraction, reaching about 40% or a bit greater, was reached with this device, which is also very important because, like I said previously, we were happy with getting 10% to the bronchial tree. Now we can talk about 40%, 50% in certain areas. So it's important to keep that in mind because that is going to allow me to achieve control where it matters and for my patients not to require the need to use their rescue medications. So fine particles less than 5 micrometers have the greatest potential to deposit throughout the airways. Flutiform has an in vitro fine particle fraction of about 40%, consistent with the average particle size of about 2.6 micrometers at a flow rate of 28.3 and 60 liters per minute, which is desirable, does not require effort. And it's numerically greater than that of fluticasone salmeterol and budesonide formoterol at both flow rates. The plume was 50% less forceful than the fluticasone propionate salmeterol MDI plume, and this means that it is slower and has the potential of reaching the airway where it matters instead of getting stuck to the airway, to the upper airways and to the oropharyngeal area. Another attribute that has not been shown to have a clinical significance, but that someday may end up to be an important feature. So plume characteristics vary between pressure dose MDIs. The plume has a lower maximum velocity, longer duration, less forceful, and had a warmer plume impact temperature than that of the fluticasone propionate salmeterol pressure dose MDI. Like I said, there is no evidence to date of any clinical benefit associated with these factors, so they remain more of a curiosity and scientific finding that may or may not translate one day into everyday clinical practice. So, like I said, highest modeled lung deposition, about 40%, which is tremendous. And in summary, patients and physicians consider a rapid onset of bronchodilatation and potent anti-inflammatory effects to be important ICS-LABA attributes. Fluticasone is a potent, sustained-acting ICS with a well-established efficacy and safety profile. Formoterol is the fastest-acting LAG-NGB-beta agonist available for treatment of asthma with a well-established efficacy and safety profile when added to an ICS therapy. This combination have now been combined in a single aerosol as Flutiform and provides an efficacious treatment option that may encourage our patient population to adhere and get better control for longer periods of time. And with that, I thank you for your attention, and I'll be ready to answer any questions you might have.